This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. It is the semi-finals of the World Cup. And Morocco stand between England and the World Cup final. No, that's just one I had in my drafts. It's the semi-finals of the World Cup. Morocco versus France and Argentina, Croatia. Is it time for Messi? Are the Croatians, you know, what kind of epic S-housery are we in store for? Or did the Argentinians use it up last time out? Meanwhile, how many times have we said, I think it's one step too far for them about Morocco? But surely France will be one step too far for them. The England inquest continues. Gareth Southgate says he wants some time before he makes a decision. And Cambridge United get a creditable draw and a clean sheet at home to high-flying Plymouth. All that plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Robin Cowan, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Mark Langdon, hello.
Hello, Max.
From Doha, Marcela Mora y Araujo, hello.
Hello.
And Barca Jim, friend of the pod, says, for Barry, how good does a fear-free semi-final preview pod feel?
Yeah, it's quite relaxing, I suppose. But I feel your pain, Max. I feel your pain.
That's all right. Let's start with Argentina-Croatia. Gonzalo Montiel, Marcus Acuna are suspended for the semi-finals. Tagliafico will probably come in for Alonso. De Paul and Di Maria should be fit to start. Croatia are not tired. All players are available. Marcela, you were there for the quarterfinal. You'll be there for the semis. How are you feeling?
Well, I was just thinking when you say fear-free, you're not talking about me, clearly. Argentina didn't choose the easy way. And, you know, here we are. It's very good news, I think, for this squad, for Messi, for Argentina fans, etc., to get to the semi-final. It's a superb kind of seal of approval and stamp of achievement. And now I think they could win. They could win this match against Croatia and then we'll be in the final. And then I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, is the world going to start spinning in an opposite direction? But I am quite fascinated by the narrative of Argentina's football and the matches and how it just seems every game has been a little improvement in whatever identifiable weakness that the match before, you know, displayed. And I'm quite fascinated by how Messi's settling into his character, the real Messi's taking shape. And I mean, a lot has been said about him being possessed by Maradona or something, because he kind of lashed out at the ref and a Dutch player, you know, the number 19, as he said. But his lashing out was saying, go away, you silly. And I think that's so messy. Like Maradona would invent an amazing new insult that was so obscene and horrible and interesting that a new language would develop. And Messi's just so kind of silly. It's such a playground. It's like something your granny would say, you know, oh, you spilt your soup, silly. And it's just become this brilliant phrase. Like within minutes, there's T-shirts that some people are mixing it with cumbia music. Maybe, you know, I can send you something, you could play it. Oh, fantastic, brilliant. New, epic kind of slogan. Go away, you silly. In Messi speak.
Oh, camera. Halabasha. Oh, camera. Halabasha. Oh, camera. Halabasha.
I think this is him settling into being comfortable being him. So obviously he's always, you know, we've always known he hates losing. He gets really angry. I interviewed him in 2009 and he told me how for ages he thought, he didn't know he was really good at football because he thought his older brothers and their mates whom he played with let him win because they knew he would have such a terrible tantrum if he didn't win. And so I just think it's a wonderful image of Messi like drooping about thinking, oh, they're going to let me win because no one wants my really strong lashing out of calling them all silly if they don't let me win. And here he is now. And, you know, I just think this idea that he's Maradona is not, it doesn't work for me. And I think you can see it in those tiny moves he suddenly does, you know, the split second in which he does something genius, like his creating that thing, passing to Molina, where you wonder how did he even see that? And then you realize he didn't see Molina. He didn't use sight in the same way as we do. And so everything is about fitting in with the team and managing his anger. Whereas Maradona was always about, you know, in 86, Maradona did that amazing run against all these English players. And Valdano was running along him. And for years and years, Valdano tells the story of how he was just hoping he would get the pass from Maradona. And then in the changing room after the match, Maradona said, "I could see you there, but I wanted the goal for myself. I wanted to just keep going and I knew I could do it." And Valdano's like, how could he see me as well as everything else? Isn't this an amazing specimen of human? And I think that's Messi's kind of playmaking in two or three instances throughout the tournament that have been the kind of pivotal point where Argentina haven't gone out because Messi's saved it. It's entirely about Messi understanding that he doesn't want it for himself. He wants the result. He wants the team result and the group result. And then you see it again when at the end, everyone rushes to celebrate together and he goes to find Dibu Martinez, because I just think he's so tuned into, he's so much part of a bigger thing. I'm fascinated by it.
I, Marcella, have been accused on social media of being an island journalist and of it being in my blood to slaughter Argentina whenever I get the chance, because I found their shithousery like just almost too much against the Netherlands. Am I a biased island journalist, do you think?
You are. Well, I know you're a biased island journalist and it's in your blood, but I think the shithousery was both ways. I mean, the Netherlands fouled actually twice as much as Argentina. And I think Van Gaal is a provocative so-and-so. I'm just going to go all messy here. I get really tough. And I think, you know, the emotions and the kind of testosterone is building up. We're getting to the end of the tournament, so feelings are very tense. And again, I just find Messi's kind of ear celebration, which we call Topo Gigio, based on a character called the Topo Gigio from my childhood. So how these guys know it, I have no idea. But that's Riquelme's celebration, famously snubbed by Van Gaal in Barcelona. And so I just think Messi's kind of incorporating all this symbolism. And he's going like that at Van Gaal, and then Edgar Davids trying to kind of calm him down. It's just brilliant. It's like the whole history of football in a single compact little drama. And you know, you could take any incident, an image, and I think, I mean, you can mind the shithousery or not mind it, but I think overall it was quite calm and contained. And you know, again, that Dibu Martinez spits on his, you know, he has all these rituals and he touches each goalpost first, and he, I don't know, it's a big thing about his penalty keeping. And then he spits in his hands and just pats the ref. But it's not any old ref. It's that Spanish guy from the Madrid-Barcelona hatred of, you know, year-long battles of medieval kind of wars in football folklore. I don't mind you not liking it, but I just think it was the most fantastic kind of theatrical exposition of, you know, we're not going to, I think it's Messi saying, I'm just not going to take it anymore. I'm angry.
I'm a massive hypocrite as well, because I do love Es Hazard. It was just Paredes just kicking at the bench. I just went, well, can't, this is ridiculous. Anyway, Robin.
Is this all leading up to Messi handballing it in the final and somehow VAR not seeing it? Is that the narrative? I just wanted to ask Marcella that it just seems this time it's not all on Messi's shoulders, even though he is instrumental and he looks like he's having the best World Cup of his career and they obviously want to do it for them. It does seem like there's a real cohesion, whereas, I don't know, the previous World Cups, it did seem like if he doesn't perform, no chance.
Well, I agree. I think it's really interesting. I mean, I think if he doesn't perform, no chance, or if for any reason he say he wasn't couldn't play, you know, I think without him, it's not a world-class team. It's a workman's team. But I do think perhaps the mistake for many years in terms of the Argentina-Messi kind of dynamic was this idea, which is what the Maradona dynamic used to be. If you just get the ball to him, he'll sort everything out. And he's not a guy that you get the ball and he sorts everything out. He needs to be generating and seeing and knowing in his head. So he's maybe just drooling around and thinking, but somehow measuring the spaces and seeing where everyone is. And that to me is the most lovely thing about his game and about how Argentina have come through. And I think one of the reasons why I worry that people are saying, oh, he's Maradonized and, you know, he's now angry and he's usually so respectful. I just think that burden of being Maradona is really needs to be avoided. And in a way, he's had his best World Cup, as you say, and looks like he's actually enjoying it, possibly because he is kind of suddenly quite comfortable being awkward Messi and doing what he needs to do. And he's found this group of this squad and this group of managers, because I think a management team is crucial here. They're not just looking to him. It's not just get the ball to Messi and then sit back and watch him. It's entirely about be there for Messi, be ready for his pass, his ball, whatever. And yeah, I think that's fascinating, actually. There's an academic paper there looking at group dynamics and leadership, the non-leading leadership.
Yeah, there's also an academic paper, Mark, on Croatia and the fact that they're still going. And, you know, what we're 13 minutes in and we haven't mentioned one of the teams in this semi-final. I think they probably wouldn't mind that, would they?
No, I think they're very comfortable playing that role. They thrived on it 4 years ago. It's coming home kind of stuff that they used to in the dressing room before the game against England to just raise themselves for one more effort. I mean, against Brazil, you know, the stats: 11 shots on target to one shot on target. But you still felt like they were always in the game. And I think they're always in the game because their midfield is so good that it takes the pressure off of the defence. They can pass around any team, particularly ones, you know, in international football where pressing's not that frequent, certainly not like it is in club football. And Argentina haven't pressed the ball much so far. So I expect Croatia to just keep popping it around them in midfield, taking sort of 3, 4, 5 minutes out of the game, slowing it down, playing it at their pace, trying to contain Messi by having the ball and not letting Argentina have the ball. They have more possession than Brazil in that quarterfinal. The one issue they've got is that if you go through the list of Argentinian forwards and the players that are not even starting and then go through the ones that Croatia have got front, there isn't that much there. I mean, Petkovic produced that moment against Brazil. And he also had one dribble, which led to a shot over the bar. But most of his play when he came on was that of like a championship target man, really. It was a real throwback to sort of 80s, 90s. He did everything slowly, but they stay in games.
Yeah. I mean, that is what we said about the Brazil. It's literally, I can remember, it's exactly what we said about previewing this game was, you look at Brazil's forwards, you look at their bench, and you look at what Croatia have got up front, and it's nothing. And I suppose, Barry, like, Croatia is a country of 4.5 million people, and they're one game away from their second consecutive World Cup final. That is ridiculous.
Yeah, it is remarkable. I mean, Croatia's only been in existence for, 30 years? I don't think people really appreciate quite how much they are punching above their weight. It would be like Ireland getting to consecutive semi-finals, you know, that in terms of population. That's absolutely unthinkable. That Ireland getting to consecutive World Cups is unthinkable.
I'd really enjoy the pods, though, Barry. I'd just like to just reverse. It would be quite extraordinary, wouldn't it?
I don't think I'd be fit I wouldn't be able to participate. I'd be just too overcome with nerves. But as I said before, it is very much one last job, and Can they get two more games out of this set of players? I certainly, you would be an absolute fool to write them off, but I do think that Argentina will win this game and that I may end up sounding daft, but I think Argentina would be too good for this.
What do you think, Robin?
On this occasion.
I just think, again, they are the T-1000 from Terminator 2, Croatia. They're just, you know, you think you've got them and then they go, and then they just run after your car. You know, it's just, they are unbelievable. And I do think that it's quite an interesting dynamic because I don't think the shithousery, if Argentina try and pull that off, will affect them. They seem to be really dead-eyed and like, okay, we'll just keep going. And but yeah, I think Mark raises a good point. I think the manager's changed the central striker three times in the last three games. So there's no attacking threat at all, but they have that control in midfield. They've not won a knockout game in 90 minutes in this World Cup or the previous one. I've heard them, a couple of people describe them as like a test match team. They just keep going. I think that's a really good analogy. So, I mean, that's the thing. It's almost like, can Argentina, I don't know, this might be a completely too much of a cliche, Marcella, but the emotion, Argentina feel like a more emotional team, whereas Croatia are just totally in control. And like, it just, who's going to come out on top in that sort of contrast of sort of moods almost?
Yeah, I mean, I think to kind of counter cliche you, the amazing thing about football is exactly that number 100 ranked can beat the number one. And it's possibly one of the few sports where that does sometimes happen. And so, but I think here we have quite evenly matched. I mean, I'm interested to watch this game. I think, I hope I can watch it.
It'd be good to get you on. It'll get you on after the semi-final. How did you make it? You said, sorry, I've covered my eyes.
Any questions? Please, yes, please, what happened? Can I have a score? I think that, yes, so the kind of stereotypes are Croatia was and Luka Modric, who was also having his own epic novella of, you know, so this is like two aging, wonderful stars. One is walking away tomorrow and the other is reaching, you know, the pinnacle of glory, and anything could happen. But just from a kind of footballing tactic point of view, which is not something I'm comfortable discussing in any way, I'm interested to see what they do. Because with the Netherlands, I was thinking, oh, Argentina have got this. You know, pass. Everything seems really nice. Who goes up? And then there was this stat about how Netherlands hadn't shot a goal at all. So you think, okay, that's actually quite scary. Because they haven't even been trying, so that's why they haven't scored. So now if they suddenly go, now we need a few goals, and they get two in a minute 100 or whatever in this new football, that's 100 minutes. So I just love it. It's also surreal. Minute 101 doesn't exist in football before this World Cup. The game's finished by then. But Kalina's now everything's delighted, happening in minute 100. Yeah. So I think it will be really interesting. And Argentina need to kind of sort out that someone was saying Argentina doesn't have a midfield. And I think they just need to sort out this, what they do with these two kind of volatile people on the side, because any tough, resilient European kind of powerhouse or Terminator assassin can break through that. I can see that's easy to do. So it will be about the passion and the emotion and the kind of general, you know, rendering to the Messi genius. Whether or not. And also, I think the other thing that's happened, I'll be as brief as I can, is that opponents of Messi have lost the fear a little bit. Mm. So whereas we used to have this kind of, oh, I'll just get a selfie with Messi, or can I swap shirts, or it's so lovely to be near you. And I see that from what I've seen, the Croatians aren't that they're not falling in love with any kind of romantic notion of South American, you know, keepy-uppy, fiddly nutmeggy. They're coming in for the kill, and I hope neutrals who enjoy it can tell me all about it.
Mark, I mean, aside from Messi and, you know, that midfield three of Croatia, like, there are other people on the pitch, right? Who else is important?
Well, I think Gavidol and Lovren at the back. You know, Lovren, much maligned from his time in England, but hasn't done much wrong, I don't think, in this World Cup. And next to him, Gavidol has been one of the best players in the tournament. And I know he's sort of up there, probably him or Fernandez probably wins the young player of the tournament, which is another award that that they give out. So I think from Croatia's point of view, those two centre-backs, because you do need to defend well. Petkovic, who I gave the rubdown to earlier on, actually, if you look at where Argentina have struggled, it is with sort of big, just knocking it long into the box. Australia caused them problems. Netherlands caused them problems. So maybe Petkovic, actually, this is a game that suits him and that they can be more direct. And for as far as Argentina are concerned, I think it's a big one that Di Maria looks like he's back and fit. Hasn't delivered too much in this World Cup because obviously he's been injured for some of it. But I actually felt when he came on, I know it was extra time and the Dutch were tired, but he made a big difference when he came on against Netherlands. And I just like the way he connects with Messi. And I think if Di Maria and Messi, you know, are playing well and they're getting Messi the ball where they need to him to deliver in that final third, then Argentina always look better when Messi's got the ball and in that sort of dangerous area. And I think Di Maria gives the ball to him better than most of those Argentinian players.
All right. Well, that'll do for our look ahead to Argentina-Croatia. Thank you, Marcella. We'll chat to you afterwards, whether you've watched the game or not.
I will watch it and I'll chat to you and I'll be connected because I've learned the internet now as well.
Marvellous. All right, we'll chat to you then. Cheers, Marcella.
See ya, thanks.
Marcella Moreira-Araujo will be on after the semi-final and that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do France versus Morocco. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly, France versus Morocco. Barry, you've been Morocco's, I wouldn't say number one fan. I've seen some people on the streets of Rabat who are slightly more excited than you, but you've been sort of bigging them up, and rightly so, since quite early in the tournament.
Yeah, and it turns out it's no surprise they're good, because I was reading this morning, I think it was an Athletic piece, back in 2007, the king or crown prince or whatever of Morocco invested millions of pounds in an academy. It's sort of like a Moroccan equivalent of St. George's Park. And this has apparently been responsible for a lot of improvement in the national team. They go into this game and I fear for them for the first time in this tournament, because Roman Saiss is desperate to be fit. I don't see how he can possibly be fit for this semi-final. He's did his hamstring against Spain, played on, did it aggravated it against Portugal and came off on a stretcher.
He'll be like the knight. He'll be like the knight in the life of Brian.
Well, Robin mentioned the T-1000 earlier. He has refused to rule himself out of the semi-final, but I will be astonished if he makes it onto the pitch. Naif Agard is also a huge doubt. He's got a low-grade tear in his thigh, which apparently takes 1 to 3 weeks to heal. And I imagine David Moyes, his manager, who hasn't really I think he's only played him once or been able to play him once since he signed for West Ham. He'll be looking on through his fingers if a guard makes it onto the pitch. Nusser Mazraoui, the first choice left back, is also a doubt, I think. And there are minor concerns over Hakim Ziyech. So they could conceivably be without their first choice back four, but they'll probably be definitely be without two of them, I'd say, and Ziyech should be okay. And then Walid Shadira is suspended. Now, he's an interesting character because he's been sort of their go-to guy for... They bring him on late doors and he gallops upfield on counter-attacks. And he's very good at, you know, getting the ball, sprinting upfield, and then finds himself one-on-one with goalkeepers and just forgets to shoot. He just runs straight into the opposition goalkeeper. So they'll be without him as well after he got sent off for two yellow cards in the quarterfinal. I would love Morocco to win this semi-final. I really would, but I think it might be a game too far for them.
Robin?
I think I agree. I mean, I'm with Barry. I'd so love them to go through. It's just such a shame, as Barry outlined there, that they've basically nearly their whole back four, if they do play, are not going to be 100%, nowhere near it. So that's such a massive shame, because obviously that was it's the basis of their whole World Cup. They've not actually been behind the whole tournament. So if they did concede first, it would be interesting to see, you know, how they would change, because they'd have to. But, you know, they still have, you know, really good players that can cause some problems. Unahi's been brilliant. I think Lars Sivertsen was saying how great he's been, you know, technically really good. Ziyech, obviously, and Boufal. They've also provided the wholesome content with the mums, haven't they, on the pitch.
So good.
It's so good. And actually, I don't think it should be underestimated that... So I did the France-Tunisia game, and obviously France made a lot of changes their third group game. And Tunisia, they're sort of rivals. You know, they were whistling the whole time. And it was really like France were the away team, and it's going to be the same this time. They really crumbled a little bit, France, under that. Obviously, they didn't play their first team. But I think that it could affect them slightly, because... Yeah, Morocco are going to outnumber the French fans by some distance. So I think that it could have some impact. But I agree with Barry. I just wonder if this might be the journey coming to an end, which would be a massive, massive shame.
It's quite hard for me, Mark, to review how well France played in the quarterfinal, because I was only watching the England players. So I'm not sure at all. But they didn't appear to be great, which makes me even sadder. But you know, like they didn't sort of have a flow about them in that game.
I totally agree that it wasn't a particularly good French performance. They won the game, and that you know, you can then start talking about, you know, a champion team. But they weren't a champion team when they were beaten by Switzerland on penalties. You know, people were saying actually there were a lot of problems in the camp. I just think they won a tight game of football. You know, that happens, you know, regularly at this kind of level when you've got two teams of a similar ability. Lloris saved a couple of the England shots that maybe on another day he doesn't, and France managed to win the match. Mbappe was kept as quiet as he could be, really. And that will be an interesting battle up against Hakimi, who is somebody that can match him for speed, but he's got a lot on Hakimi because he's such an attacking outlet for Morocco as well. And he maybe won't be able to do that as much because of the fearfulness of Mbappe. In midfield, they protect the defence reasonably well, but, you know, Griezmann is the one that offers the creativity. Otherwise, you know, you don't get too much in terms of that sort of creativity in the midfield areas. And even at the back, there were times when I wasn't convinced about that left-hand side, particularly Upamecano is very rash, and Teo Hernandez is almost like a wing-back, really playing as a left-back. He wants to be in the attacking third rather than defending. So I don't see this as being like a complete French team. When they were in the semi-finals 4 years ago, They look so solid, and I was wondering how you were supposed to sort of score against them, because if you overcommitted, they would just hurt you on the counter-attack. They were strong on set pieces. This team, I don't think, is quite as good as that one, but they might not need to be for all the reasons that have been outlined already as to sort of, you know, Morocco's problem. So I don't think it was a great French performance, but they are in the... You know, they've got the easier semi-final, and they should make the final. There are no excuses for them not to make the final.
Phil sent in a question actually after the quarterfinal, Barry, which said, "Has Lloris been in deep cover at Spurs, convincing England that he's a liability? He, like, he's got a rick in him, and he hasn't made any of them yet."
Yeah, he hasn't. There haven't been any obvious howlers, or certainly none that spring to mind. But I still think he hasn't looked hugely convincing. He did play quite well against England, but I still very much think he has a rick in him. I think we mentioned before that apart from a couple of notable exceptions, the standard of goalkeeping in this tournament hasn't been brilliant. And I would say of the two goalkeepers in the semi-final, I would rather have Bono than Lloris. But yeah, he hasn't done much wrong.
I suppose what's interesting from both these games, Mark, is they feel like they will look similar, right? It's not like neither game will have both teams going at it. I know Croatia and Morocco will play it in slightly different ways. Croatia try and keep the ball without attacking. Morocco are just happy to defend. But you sort of have a similar feel to both games.
You would have thought so. There are two strong favourites in the matches. Also think from an atmosphere point of view, you have got like what will feel like two home / away games, as Robin said there, and those fans will be important for Morocco because Amrabat was he looked exhausted against Portugal. I don't know how much ground he has covered in this tournament, but he's been remarkable. But he could barely run when the clock was ticking on again past that sort of 100-minute mark or whatever against Portugal, and so you do worry about that energy from the Moroccan point of view. And if France score first, where the games might be different is if France score first, I would imagine that would be it for that semi-final. If Argentina score first, I'm not switching off because, you know, Croatia probably won't get going until it gets to about 85 minutes anyway. So that's where the games might be different. I agree that there are two fairly strong favourites, but there's one team that I would fancy to come back more than the other.
What final do you want, Barry?
I honestly don't mind any permutation. I think I would like to see Argentina in the final, against whom I'm not bothered. But, I would like to see Argentina in the final. I would like to see Morocco in the final. So Argentina-Morocco.
What about you, Robin?
I'd like to see Croatia-Morocco because no one would have expected it. It's like a kind of... So when Swansea and Bradford made it to the Carabao Cup. Yeah, it's like that. I mean, the TV companies would be absolutely furious. They'll all want a France-Argentina, won't they? Because that's the sort of box office one. But yeah, I'd love to see it. My prediction, because I'm still hurting and I can't put France through, is that Hernandez will attempt another shoulder barge and cock it up, and then Morocco will score a penalty and get through.
So I think Rabiot afterwards was saying, you know, it wasn't a penalty.
I've
talked about this. I mean, it's
like ludicrous.
Managers and players do this all the time. You know, it's not just Rabiot. Is it? They just go, yeah, look, the referee's got... He's not going to go back and change his decision. You're through, for goodness sake. It was so obviously a foul. Mark, what do you want to see?
I want to see Argentina against France. I feel like from a final point of view, I would like to see the two best teams. I was just about to say going at it, but you don't tend to go at it, do you, in World Cup finals? Even then, I'd imagine it'd be pretty sort of pedestrian pace. That's just the way most international matches are. But yeah, I mean, Mbappe against Messi, Argentina against France would, I think, be the best final. We don't always get that, though, and so I wouldn't be surprised if there was a twist somewhere, but it would more likely, I think, to come in the Argentina game.
We do get the third, fourth place playoff as well, though, don't we? Everyone's looking forward to that.
What a third, fourth playoff. That would be Argentina v France.
Jamie says, if Morocco beat France and then Croatia, is this the smallest geographical region of teams to beat in the knockouts on the way to the World Cup final and winning it? Spain, Portugal, France, Croatia, they basically won the Euros. We had a really interesting email from Adam. And he says, hey, Max, everyone. Adam from Morocco here. Old Premier League fan, long-time listener of the podcast. Barry has always been one of my heroes, Steady.
Oh, Jesus.
With both his... It's not the point of the email, but, you know, it's some praise for you. Because normally Barry...
You could just stop there.
Yeah, no, normally Barry zones out of these long emails, but he might listen to this one because it's praised him. Barry's always been one of my heroes with both his enthusiasm for an overlooked interesting story and yet total indifference to whatever is happening in world football, or life for that matter. This isn't the first time he's made what seemed like massive crazy calls before games, only to be vindicated. This time is bigger than others for me, so I really appreciated his fairness and belief in the Moroccan team's solidity, even when I didn't. This is a bit of a weird tangent, but if there is one place that would hear it, it's this one, so I'll take my shot. As an Amazigh, aka Berber person, I hope that I've pronounced that correctly, I get a little bit upset when people celebrate Morocco's victories as a win for the Arab or Muslim world. Not that I'm not happy to share the win with these communities, but nobody ever mentions us when we're half of the Moroccan population. Most of the Moroccan players in Europe come from Berber families, especially from places like Germany, Belgium and Holland. Hakimi, Ziyech, Amrabat and even superstars like Benzema, Zidane and Mahrez are all Berber players. People are happy for the relatively small footballing nation that is Morocco, and I get and I appreciate that a lot. But since Amazighs have no representation in the Arab or even Moroccan media, which again can be put in a lengthy historical context, it would really mean the world to me if at least my favourite podcast gives us some credit and best wishes. In every Moroccan game of this World Cup, you'll see the Amazigh flag flying high. It was even confiscated during one of the games by Qatari officials who mistook it for an LGBTQ plus flag, a mix-up I'm always proud to support. I'm really sorry for going on this boring rant, but our culture is thousands of years old. We have our own languages, customs, food, music, clothes, traditions, which are deeply African. It's a unique culture that has and continues to influence Moroccan and North African identity to be what it is today. And I thought this would be a nice opportunity to let the world know that we exist. Thank you, Max, and everyone for constantly providing an incredibly informative, empathetic and entertaining show. Thank you to everyone who's supported us so far around the world. It's a victory for you as much as it is for us. P.S. If Juve can renew Rabiot's contract before our game on Wednesday, that would be great. Cheers. Thank you so much, Adam. Despite your taste in Barry, we appreciate that email. And that'll do for part two. We'll round up any other business in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. The Southgate fallout continues. Robin and Mark, Barry thinks Southgate has failed. I want him to stay.
That's harsh.
Okay.
That is an unfair assessment, I think. I've noticed, just having had sort of time to think about it and read all the fallout and coverage, that the Southgate, it seems to be split into people who think he can do no wrong and people who think he can do no right. I'm somewhere in the middle. I think he's done a fine job in some regards, an absolutely outstanding job. But I do think he has obvious shortcomings that need to be addressed. Does this mean I think he should leave, quit or be sacked? No, I can't think of anyone better for the job. But I do think his touchline management is very poor and is costing England.
Robin and Mark, fascinated to hear your sort of your review of that quarterfinal and of what Barry said about Southgate. Robin.
Yeah, I think, I'm quite biased because I'm someone who, while I'd like England to do well, I'm kind of more bothered about what he stands for and how he speaks so eloquently about important issues. And I think I was really thinking back to before he came in, and the culture and just the narrative around England. And I do think that's, maybe a lot of people won't agree with this, but the way he's changed the culture around England and the way that the players, you know, clearly adore him, it's just night and day. When you think about them splayed on the floor against Iceland and they just forgot how to play football and it was just so toxic, I just think it's been absolutely remarkable. I agree with Barry in that, yeah, maybe, you know, it's difficult to talk about his tactics and his mistakes because I just don't feel like I'm in the position to judge on that. And I do think, I don't know who else would come in. I honestly don't know. And you need someone who would carry on that culture and the positivity around the England camp. I just think it's bloody hard to win a tournament. Only one country, only one team can win it. And he's got really close. And yeah, maybe he's made mistakes, perhaps, but he's been the most successful England manager since Ralph Ramsey. So I don't think we can really complain too much about not winning something that's really hard to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's moved the team on from the Euros. I know they reached the final of the European Championship, but that tournament I didn't think was that great. When you actually analyse England's performances, they played well against Ukraine and for a small period against Germany, but the group stage just wasn't good football. The semi-final against Denmark could easily have gone the other way, and that's why I don't tend to look at, I think you can get blindsided by just results because, you know, Harry Kane missed a penalty in that semi-final against Denmark. The ball bounced back to him and he was able to tap it in. And that looks completely different to what happened then against France, where he missed a penalty and then England go out. But I felt
he'd have had to go a long way to get the rebound.
He would. that is right. But I felt that England played, you know, well in the group stages. Okay, the USA game was harder, but USA are not a team that you can just turn up and just thrash. You know, they are on their day a team that's capable of giving sort of bigger nations in inverted commas in terms of sort of footballing history a tough game. And the way that England sort of dealt with that last 16 game against Senegal and improved as the match went on, changed the way they were playing, I didn't feel like that was possible in the Euros. They just played the same. Every kind of minute just felt the same. And then against France, they could easily have won that game. They didn't win it. I've been a critic of Southgate, I would say, in his time as England manager, because I also feel like in 2018 they could easily have gone out to Colombia, and he probably wouldn't even be in the job now. So I feel like he's improving. I like the formation, the way they set up against France. I felt it was the right thing to do. They played well. I'm sure if somebody else came in, you look at the people that are kind of being mentioned. I'm not, Graham Potter, Pochettino, Eddie Howe. I think they would represent the country in the same kind of way the way that Southgate has done. But I don't see why any of them really would fancy that job. I mean, two of them have got big club opportunities, and I'm just against established nations having foreign managers. I just fundamentally disagree with that at international level, because I think what's the point of international football if it's not your best goalkeeper against the best goalkeeper and the best manager against the best manager? And so I would be against Pochettino for that reason, or Thomas Tuchel. And so I would probably give Southgate the Euros. And also, it's only, 18 months now until the Euros. So it's a quick turnaround. I don't see the point in making a change now.
Cipello says, why are so many England players starting tweets with words can't describe how devastated they are, followed by paragraphs of words describing how devastated they are? It does seem, Barry, that there hasn't yet been a kind of knives out fallout for Harry Kane or for the manager or for the players.
No, there hasn't, and I don't think there will be. I think it would have started by now if it was going to happen. Everyone has been hugely supportive of Southgate and of Kane. I was sad to see today, sad but unsurprised to see Troy Townsend flagging up the fact that Bukayo Saka has been getting more racial abuse on Twitter, and I think if it had been black player who'd missed the penalty, the knives would be out. And that's just a sad fact of life. I'm not sure what can be done about it beyond trying to identify culprits and prosecute them. But I'm surprised by how incredibly supportive everyone has been.
Robin, I mean, part of it is, he's clearly a good guy, Gareth Southgate, right? That makes a big difference. Harry Kane is a good guy, as Barry makes a very good point about that. And like it shouldn't be reflective of, oh, you've done something bad, therefore you get racially abused, or you were good. But I mean, mm-hmm. Saka was the best player on the pitch for England. Like, it's so ridiculous. I mean, it's completely ridiculous. Not that that makes a difference on, you know, being racially abused, but it's just that is just a depressing part of social media, I guess.
Oh, yeah. No, totally. That just baffles me. Totally baffles me. I mean, as you say, it doesn't matter what happens, but that's really baffling. I really, really don't get that at all. And it's just awful. When you really, you know, I've come off Twitter mainly because, you know, it was actually really nice not to be on it and I couldn't check it when I was out in Qatar. But you get kind of just, even just needly comments really got to me. And actually it's like, you don't need it. And it just brings out the worst people. I've not had racist comments, obviously, but it's just...
Did you come off because you were commentating on the World Cup on BBC One and you just didn't... There will always be people who don't like you.
Basically,
you
personally, yeah.
Because you're such a horrible person, Robin. But, you know, everybody gets stick, right? And you just didn't want to see it.
Yeah, exactly. And I know I'm not someone who can handle that very well. And I think it's interesting that I feel like, I don't know, the players have to be on social media almost. I guess they don't have to look at it personally, but I guess, I don't know, are they forced to be because of their brand?
I wonder if you're young, right? If you're in your 20s, everyone's on social media. So like, what do you do when you get in the dressing room afterwards? Like at some point you'll pick up your phone, won't you? And you hope that they are managed in a way to say, just don't, I mean, imagine if you have so many million followers, you just don't, your mentions, it just gets too much, right? You just wouldn't be able to see them. But you hope exactly. that they get that guidance, right?
This is a sort of separate issue and sort of on Southgate, just generally, and this is not me blaming him at all, but I think we've all moved on from the, you know, the sort of armband thing, because that's been forgotten. Barry, you were very strong on this and I agreed with every single word. I really feel like that was a failure in leadership. You know, as soon as a sanction was sort of saying, oh, you might get booked for wearing this, you know, this armband that wasn't even, it was kind of very woolly to start with. I felt very let down. And not, you know, as someone who's not LGBTQ+, but I feel like they must have felt very, very let down. And in terms of like what the England team represented, that would have really been a big blow to that sort of community. Sorry, that's a bit off topic, but...
No, not at all. I mean, we're going to do a sort of a podcast on off the pitch later this week to talk about sort of everything that has happened and, you know, whether things worked that we didn't expect them to and how, you know, covering everything, which is obviously quite a lot to cover. Mark, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, it was more on the social media aspect, really, where I saw a video with Jermaine Genius talking, saying that it's by accident that you see your notifications quite often, because you maybe just message a friend and you kind of click on maybe the mentions when you don't even, you know, you're going to blank out the mentions, but you just click on it by mistake, and then, you know, you can't help but then just see the whole... just abuse after abuse. And just on the abuse front, I mean, it hasn't started yet on Harry Kane. I think it might be interesting when he's playing at away grounds as to how that changes. I mean, he's not the most loved guy anyway, in sort of terms of away venues. And I think he will have to, unfortunately, put up with a fair bit of stick. You know, the songs about you let your country down been aimed at other players before and probably will be him. He's just going to have to deal with that aspect of it, unfortunately. But yeah, I would be surprised if he doesn't get that.
I think David Heitner wrote a piece in The Guardian, which I read yesterday, about this is like the biggest setback for him into his career. I mean, he said, obviously, there's, you know, released by Arsenal, he's lost cup finals with Spurs and everything, but he personally has pretty much done everything he could in those situations, whereas this was like an error that was totally on him. And obviously, you know, things happen, you know, I don't think, you know, you should blame him, but it's almost like this is the biggest sort of personal setback of his career. So it will be interesting to see how he responds. He comes across as quite a strong person, but you could see I've never seen him look quite so gutted. Max.
No, that's okay. It would be great for him. I mean, obviously the chance of Tottenham winning the Champions League is zero, or the league, but Just imagine at the end of the narrative if he managed to have one of those by the end. Fraser says, Kyle Walker and John Stones bringing Dave the Cat back to Manchester is a lovely little story in contrast to all of the unpleasantness. Yes, Kyle Walker and John Stones adopted a stray cat at Al Wakra training base during their time in Qatar. They called the cat Dave, vowed to take him home if England were to win the World Cup. Well, they didn't win the World Cup, but they have taken Dave home nonetheless. And presumably, we do hope that Dave was a stray cat. It didn't have a little collar around, I'll say. Yeah.
Are we sure Dave wanted to go to live in Manchester?
The weather's shit.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe he's like one of those footballers who'd rather be in London. You know? Yeah.
The bright lights.
Swanning around the West London with Ben Mee.
Mm. Well, it's a big school. If and when Kyle Walker or John Stones move on from Manchester City, who gets custody of Dave? Like, that is a big question. Something we'll have to follow over the years.
He'd probably just take up residence at the training ground and then...
At City.
Yeah, I'd imagine that would be the... I mean, I know there's a cat in my dad's old veterinary surgery that... He just ended up being the resident cat. So it doesn't matter who's there. There's one little thing. I don't know if you've seen this story, which has emerged from the USA camp about Gio Reyna.
Right. In
so far as a lot of American fans were complaining that he didn't get enough minutes, but apparently his lack of application and attitude at the camp and coming ahead of the World Cup were so bad that they were actually going to kick him out and send him home. But he was forced then basically to stand up at a team meeting and apologize for his lack of effort. And they allowed him to stay. But that is why he didn't get as many minutes as some fans thought he should have.
I mean, when are you, Barry, going to stand up and apologise to all of us? Anyway, let's finish on another dream. Mike says, not a question, just wanted to share my Football Weekly dream with you. I'd been slightly annoyed by the underperformance at Uruguay at this World Cup as I'd drawn them in my work World Cup sweepstakes. I thought I'd gotten over this until Max Rushton appeared to me in a dream. Max, you appeared fronting one of those diesel emissions claim style action groups in a YouTube ad. Did you draw Uruguay in your World Cup sweepstakes? You may be entitled to compensation. After giving my details, I was put in touch with a camo-wearing mercenary who looked like Rambo, but had the voice and mannerisms of Barry. Me and Rambo Barry boarded a flight to Asuncion, with Barry carrying a suitcase full of high-powered weapons. I remember discussing with Rambo Barry that Asuncion isn't in Uruguay, to which he replied that they're hiding in Paraguay and that he's the only one that knows how to find the Uruguayan FA, which is why I'd made such a good choice of being represented by Max Rushton's claims group. I woke up before we found them, so I'll never know where the dream was going or how many people Barry would have slaughtered. Do you think I have a genuine case for reimbursement of my £5 from the Uruguayan FA? And how big a cut would you take if you could help me get my claim through? Well, thank you, Mike. Barry and I will put £2.50 each in our pockets. And if we ever see you, you can demand your fiver. And that'll do for today's semi-final preview. Thanks, Barry.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Max.
Football Weekly was produced by Silas Gray with Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens. We'll be back on Tuesday for the first semi-final.
This is The Guardian.